I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. In 1967, exactly a year before he would be assassinated, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. warned of three evils that would threaten our democracy: racism, poverty, and militarism. What progress have Americans made in the past 5 decades against these evils? Has there been progress or retreat during the 2 terms of America's first black president? In this Martin Luther King Day edition of Midday, we'll hear from talk show host Tavis Smiley about what's holding black America back. And we're joined by Johns Hopkins professor and author Lester Spence, who concludes that the political ideology called neoliberalism has devastated poor and working class black communities. The pressures on black America on Midday after the news.
That we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. On the one hand, we are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside, but that will be only an initial act. One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring.
Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad to be able to spend part of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday with you. We just heard his voice from a speech he gave 49 years ago, exactly a year before he was assassinated in 1968. Dr. King's call for a revolution, for a new way of thinking, reverberates in the thinking of both of our guests on Midday today. I spoke on Friday with talk show host, author, and philanthropist Tavis Smiley, who is on a tour promoting the book he just edited, The Covenant with Black America, 10 Years Later. We're going to play parts of that interview during this hour. But let me start with one of the first points Tavis Smiley made to me, connecting Dr. King's warning with the situation these days in Baltimore.
King's triple threat comprised of racism, poverty, and militarism. Now, as we celebrate him once again this year, I ask you to think about what threatens this democracy: racism, poverty, and militarism. If there's a city in the country that understands that better than anybody, it's Baltimore. We saw the militarism on display in the aftermath of the murder of Freddie Gray, racism alive and well in Baltimore, poverty gripping the city. So Baltimore is exhibit A in what has to be addressed if we're going to make America the great nation that she can be.
With me in the studio is a thinker with his own challenging analysis about the threats black America faces and how the African-American community has lost so much ground over the last decade. Lester Spence is Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He's also the author of 2 books, 2011's Stare into Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics, and just published Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. That book was published last month by Punctum Books. Lester Spence, welcome back to Midday.
Oh, thanks. Good to be here.
So you point to neoliberalism as the root cause of so many problems in the black community. What is neoliberalism?
So neoliberalism is the public policies, set of ideas, and institutional arrangements that has at its base just one simple idea: every institution, every aspect of human life should be governed or structured in order to perform by the dictates of the free market. That that those policies include. So if we think about poverty, for example, we're talking about poverty. It represents a transformation from welfare to workfare. So neoliberal policy actually suggests that the best way to deal with poverty is to incentivize poor people to work on their own and to take responsibility for their own behavior. If we think about the transformation in public schools, it's about using market principles in order to shape how kids learn, in order to shape how schools are actually governed, in order to kind of sort of figure out how even higher education schools like Johns Hopkins should be oriented. And the end result tends to be really, really, really high levels of inequality, and then a number of other things that usually spin off from inequality, whether we're talking about high levels of anxiety at the deeply personal level or high levels of racial inequality.
Because some people are going to heard your first few sentences describing relying on the kind of judgments that businesses make to see if something, if they're making a profit, if something's working in a business context. And they think, what is wrong with applying that analysis? I mean, why is that? Why is the analysis itself, that type of analysis, of such great concern?
Because of the effect it has on how people live, right? So if you look at levels of inequality from 1929 to now, it takes the shape of a U, high levels in 1929, high levels now, and really low levels in the middle. And it's those high levels of inequality that we should be concerned with, because it reduces our capacity to really function as a society. It reduces our capacity to give everybody the opportunity to live fruitful lives. Even if we think about it in a business sense, right, it reduces the ability of businesses to perform because they're unable to fully access and tap into the innovation and creativity of our citizens, because large swaths of them simply can't be fully integrated into the economy. That's a very narrow set of reasons why we should be concerned, but I'd suggest even those reasons are enough.
Your book deals both with the macro and the micro. You talk about the organization of the economy, the organization of societies, but you also talk about, as you just mentioned, how this plays out for individuals, especially in the Black community these days. And you cite the rapper Jay-Z. I want folks to hear the line that, or the verse that includes the line that you mention so often.
Nothing to me. Difficult takes a day, impossible takes a week. I do this in my sleep. So I'm guessing I could sell CDs. I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. Let me handle my business. Damn, Kanye's, you got me.
I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. That was Jay-Z. Why is that so relevant to what you're talking about?
So what he's basically talking about, and is the part that was actually edited, bleeped out, so to speak, was when he said, I sold kilos so I can sell CDs, right? So it's this idea that he's actually worked entrepreneurially in the drug game, and that naturally transitions into his ability to sell CDs. And then when he says, I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman, he's suggesting that that the standard we should be aiming for is not simply to be an entrepreneur, but to literally become a business ourselves. And the thing is with that is, not only does it kind of reduce human capacity and human life to like crass concerns of profit and loss, but it also it requires a great deal. So the title of the book is Knocking the Hustle. To be that requires a significant amount of grind and hustle. And even in the best case scenario, only a thin slice of American people in this context actually have the ability to do that, much less get the benefits of it. By definition, the market actually creates a dynamic where people are competing against each other. So you're going to have winners and you're going to have a large number of losers. There's no way to go about it. There's no way to kind of... Once you take that as the principle, you're guaranteeing a society in which you have a large amount of losers who then deserve their loss.
Let me just remind listeners that they're listening to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking to Professor Lester Spence of Johns Hopkins University, whose latest book is Knocking the Hustle: Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. And you're certainly welcome to be part of this conversation. Our local number is 410-662-8780. We have a toll-free number also if you'd like to call from afar. That is 866-661-9309. And our email address is midday@wypr.org. We'd like you to be part of the conversation. Of course, very few people could be turn themselves into businesses the way Jay-Z does. But is it bad for many of us to just try to push ourselves a little further and hustle a little more?
Yeah, that takes a it really takes a toll. All right, so we're going to be talking. We're talking about Martin Luther King. So the moment when he's really when he's making that speech in 1967, for the first time, it's like we're thinking about ways to reorient the society in such a way as to give people more freedom and more leisure time with which to think about other ways to live. What that hustle and grind does, it actually flips that on its head and suggests that, you know what, instead of us actually needing more leisure time, maybe we should actually spend more time developing ourselves and transforming our human capital, right? I mean, you take something like Uber to the point where we're actually using our cars as taxis, in the case of Uber, mm-hmm. or using our homes as like rental properties, in the case of something like Airbnb, right? There's that mode of life generates nothing or tends to generate high levels of anxiety and significant levels significant levels of poverty.
When did this start?
So I chart its growth. So I talked about that curve. That inequality curve starts to go back up, you know, generating higher levels around 1970 or so.
High inequality early in the 20th century that came down during the New Deal and its after effects.
Yeah, and the Great Society, Civil Rights Movement. It starts to go back up at around 1970 or so. And ostensibly, that's because the economy tanks here and elsewhere in the world, in the advanced industrial societies. And you had high levels of inflation, high levels of unemployment. Those are two things that aren't supposed to happen at the same time, right? So you usually have inflation when you have a whole bunch of people participating, you know, consuming goods. But in this case, you didn't really have that because most people were out of work. So in that gap, because you couldn't use the same economic ideas to solve the economy, because the presence of high inflation and high unemployment showed that those ideas were broken, a new set of ideas that we now, you know, that we now call neoliberal ideas end up coming into the gap, suggesting that we needed aggressive tax cuts, suggesting that we needed to reduce the size of the welfare state, suggesting that we needed to reduce workers' ability to organize.
Ed is calling us from Pasadena with, I think, perhaps a question like mine, which is why is it called neoliberalism? Ed, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Yes, I wanted to ask your guest to distinguish between 19th century economic liberalism, which would be kind of conservative today, and 20th century political liberalism, which I don't think he's talking about. Thank you.
That's an absolutely great question. So what he's talking about is kind of classical liberalism, ideas about property rights, ideas about about individuals' ability, individual freedom. The primary thing that distinguishes neoliberalism, the thing I'm talking about from that 19th century mode, is that people believed in that point that the free market was something that was natural, that was naturally created, and all we had to do was just kind of let it exist and it would just take root. What neoliberals believe is that the free market is something that's incredibly fragile, and you have to actively use government to create it. You have to actively use government to create that kind of drive in individuals. It's not something that just happens naturally. That's the primary thing that I would say distinguishes 19th century liberalism, classical liberalism, from 20th century neoliberalism.
Ed, I appreciate the call. We need to take a short break here. I'm in the studio with Lester Spence, author of Knocking the Hustle: Against the neoliberal turn in black politics. Professor Spence will be with us the rest of the hour, and we'll also hear more from my interview with Tavis Smiley last week. And I hope you'll join the conversation. I'm curious as to whether what you're hearing matches your own impression of what's going on in black America. Our local number is 410-662-8780. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We also have a toll-free number, 1-866-661-9309. I'm Sheila Kest. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Kast, here in the studio with Lester Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins. His new book is Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. We're taking calls at 410-662-8780, and our email address is midday@wypr.org. Professor Spence, I want to share what struck me as the core of Tavis Smiley's analysis of the challenges to black America. And by way of background, in 2006, 10 years ago, Smiley was the editor of what turned into a bestseller, The Covenant with Black America. It was not only a collection of essays outlining the primary concerns of African Americans, but offered a national action plan to solve them. So a decade later, they said, let's look at this. They commissioned new research. Last week, they published an update, The Covenant with Black America, 10 years later. It concludes that in every major economic category, African Americans have lost ground over the past 10 years. And here's part of how Tavis Smiley summarized the new research in our interview.
Oh, in short order, number one, not in any particular order, black wealth has evaporated. We have seen the evisceration of black wealth over the last 10 years, much of that in large measure due to the Great Recession. But we have lost more black wealth in the last decade than at any point in African-American history, number one. Number two, one need only look at the ongoing crisis regarding employment in black America. The unemployment number is still too high. It's come down somewhat, but there's still too much unemployment, too much underemployment, and too many black folk who no longer even looking for work at the moment because the recession and the residual effect of it still being felt by black America. We've not made much ground in housing. The housing burst, and these banks who were caught putting black folk in bad loans has caused some setback. So just the range, the gamut of economic factors indicate that we have not gained any ground over the last decade.
And who is at fault?
Ooh, great question, Sheila. There are a lot of people at fault. There's enough blame to go around. I should start by saying that this book came out, again, prior to Barack Obama being elected president, and clearly these issues existed in black America before he showed up. It's not his fault per se. We can't lay all this at his feet. But these problems did exacerbate. They did get worse under the almost now two terms, of his presidency. So I would say, number one, racism is default because racism is still the most intractable issue in this country. Number two, black folk themselves are to be faulted, in part because I think we've been too deferential to this president. Sometimes being too deferential can be detrimental. And when you don't hold people accountable, you make no demands, you get nothing. So we've been too deferential. And thirdly, there's been too much political indifference. We start with the Republican obstructionism, the headwind this president's been up against. He did get a great deal done, but there's a lot of obstructionism, a lot of blocking. Mitch McConnell kept his promise made early on in the first term that he wanted to beat Barack Obama, and he kept his word for all these years. They have not been a good partner working with him on any number of issues. So you put those factors together, plus more, there's plenty of blame to go around.
Professor Spence, I'm curious about what you think when you hear all that. I mean, I guess part of me is wondering whether Tavis Smiley and his team get to some of the same conclusions you do by a different route.
It's complicated. It's funny. So for the folk who are just listening, as Sheila's talking, you can't see this. As Sheila's talking to me and I'm listening to that clip, or as we're both listening to the clip, rather, I'm just like got my head like basically just in my hands, because I not only understand this stuff from this perspective of a social scientist, I actually underwent that. You know, so in the past 10 years, what I came close to losing the house twice. I am now approximately like $80,000 or $90,000 underwater. My mortgage with my kids. You know, I've got a kid graduating now. Another kid will be starting college next semester, and I don't quite know how fully we're going to be able to cover that. Right. So this is something that I'm living under. With that said, I think that what he gave is kind of it's a neat and pat answer, but what I would suggest is not simple as saying it's racism, it's black people and political indifference. Like, yeah, all that stuff is going on, but what is it concretely, right? So let's look at Baltimore, right? And let's look at, I'm going to focus on the militarism aspect of that Martin Luther King quote. Over the last 20 years, 25 years, Baltimore's police spending has increased from $145 million to $475 million, right? But at the same time, Baltimore's spending on parks and recs has remained stable. They spent $36 million in 1990. They spend approximately $36 million now, right? What is it that causes that shift in policing? Now, we can talk about the national changes in the economy and how those changes are then reflected in a city like Baltimore. But then we can also talk about the decisions of local political actors, black political actors, whether we're talking about the mayor, whether we're talking about city council members, whether we're talking about, to a certain extent, people in Congress, to actually make a decision and say, okay, it's more important that we put police on the ground than it is that we provide economic opportunities for our kids or that we provide park space for our citizens, right? If we talk about racism, political indifference, and black folk without boiling down, you know, without getting as fine-grained as we can and saying, okay, what exactly are you talking about? Then you don't really give people the ability to politically respond. And then in my case, as a social scientist, you don't give us the ability to really examine why this stuff rises and falls over time. I mean, racism has always been with us. Political indifference has kind of always been with us. And black folk have always kind of been conservative as far as responding to black power. Right. So we need to be able to take a much finer grained analysis. And that's what I try to do in the book.
OK, so particularly on the question of local black leadership, what do you conclude after all your analysis this what you call the neoliberal turn, the movement toward embracing business principles as guidance for government is as true in many of the examples, including Baltimore, that you include in your book.
Yes.
In cities, it's as true in cities with black leadership as in other cities.
So that's the perfect. So when I talk, so my argument is that that neoliberalism has basically infected black politics, so to speak. So if you look at so that turn in 1970 happens about the time you see a rise in black elected officials, a rise in a certain type of black power, given the changes in the civil rights movement. Now, how does that come into play in a city like Baltimore? Baltimore doesn't start electing black mayors until what, the mid to the 80s and 90s, right? But what we see is we see black elected officials in Baltimore and in other cities, in part because of constraints placed on the cities themselves, start to adopt neoliberal policies.
When you say constraints, you're talking about strings attached to federal grants?
Yes.
Federal money?
Yep. So there was a moment in time in which cities could rely on the federal government to get some money back, right? So city would pay a certain amount of money out to the federal government in taxes. The federal government would give that money back to them, and then they would then use those monies to provide social services. But that stuff gets cut beginning in Nixon's era, and Reagan finally kills it, forcing cities to kind of do what they can do with their own resources. And then because of a combination of corporate flight and middle class flight, cities are forced to reduce their tax burden in order to attract businesses and citizens back into the city. So those constraints, those dynamics place significant constraints on the ability of political officials at the local level to make changes, to make progressive changes. But with that said, they're still making choices. So I talked about the spending, the stable spending in Parks and Recs. It was Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, I believe, who actually argued that we should privatize, again, using business logic, we should actually privatize recreation centers because they'll be better managed under private, using the market than by government, right? It was Stephanie Rawlings Blake who, before the policing problems really became public, argued that we actually, at the biggest problem we had was black people killing black people, not the police doing the same thing. So what we see is that combination of kind of hardcore rhetoric against black poor populations and combined with policy rhetoric designed to reduce the ability or reduce Baltimore's footprint as far as city spending on progressive policies.
Pat is calling us from Baltimore with, I think, a comment or a question very, very, very much related to this. Pat, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This is great information. There's a book called The Book of Meme Law that describes all that's going on that you're talking about. And I'm wondering if you don't see, they used to have this term called trickle down. And do you not think that what is occurring now, if you take away racism and everything that divides us, if you just don't see streaming up going on, and what covers it is the ability to keep us at odds with each other?
That's a great question and a great comment. So the trickle-down idea that that Reagan kind of popularized proposes that if we give high-income folk and if we give corporations the ability to kind of act unfettered, then they'll unleash a great deal of innovation, creativity, and those results will trickle down to the rest of us. That's kind of neoliberal policy as far as tax policy in a nutshell. It's the idea that we just give, you know, we reduce these burdens, we let people kind of do what they're going to do, and then the people will generate benefits far in excess of what they would have generated had they been burdened by taxes. And it's that dynamic that then trickles down, so to speak, to kind of urban policy, where cities across the country, particularly hard-hit cities like Baltimore or St. Louis, who just lost the Rams, or Detroit or Gary, Indiana, those decisions they have to make. They're like, you know what? What we need to do is we'll bring in businesses, or we'll bring in sports teams, or we'll bring in tourism, and then we'll lower the tax rate such that when they come in, they'll spend so much money that everybody will benefit. And they never do, often forcing these same cities to ramp up their spending on policing.
Pat, I appreciate your calling us. And I would remind our listeners, you can call, too. You can be part of this conversation. Our local number is 410-662-8780. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. You make the point repeatedly in your book, Knocking the Hustle, that the distrust of government, which seems to be inherent in this neoliberal ideology, means that instead of using government as a tool, say, to address inequalities, the attitude is get government out of the way.
Yes. So the perfect example that people, and I mentioned Detroit earlier, perfect example that people in the state of Michigan are dealing with now is the Flint water crisis. So the Flint water crisis was basically generated as a result of neoliberal policy. The city of Flint, Michigan, Flint is about the second or third largest city in the state of Michigan, predominantly black population, predominantly poor population. Used to be home to GM a long time ago. Flint was placed under emergency financial management. It was basically placed under the control of the state several years ago because of the idea that it practiced fiscally unsound forms of management. So the state took over. The governor of Michigan is a businessman. He was elected to be governor because it was felt that he could bring business-oriented solutions to the state, and this, the emergency financial management policy, was kind of one of those business solutions. So they put a manager in charge of the city, an unelected manager. One of the first decisions he makes is he decides to stop piping Flint water in from Detroit, but rather to use a local water source. The pipes were corroded. The pipes were corroded. So he's basically piping in bad water. GM's engine plant stopped using the water because it was corroding the parts. But citizens kept on using it. They kept on reporting it was bad, but local officials basically ignored them. And now it's been revealed that approximately 9,000 kids have really, really high levels of lead poisoning. So the solution in that dynamic would normally be a massive influx of government. It would be to use government to solve the problem. But now you've so tainted government itself, because government was the one that caused the problem, it's going to be very difficult, if impossible, to get those citizens to say, you know what, government's really to blame and government's the solution, as opposed to maybe, as opposed to philanthropy or something else. Like Cher gave, I think Cher sent like 180,000 bottles of water there. And that's not going to do it, right? That you can't get the scale that's needed there without government.
Okay. And maybe you'll say that the question I'm about to ask just shows the extent to which I have been influenced by neoliberalism without knowing until I read your book what it was. But there are certainly examples of government failures at the local level. Let's just talk at the local level.
Yes.
I'm thinking of some of the criticisms of the housing department in Baltimore City that make people think, let's set up some kind of public-private partnership. Let's set up something because the city isn't doing this right.
Yeah.
There certainly is cause for people to be skeptical that government, without the pressure of the same kind of bottom line pressure that businesses face, just drops the ball too often.
Well, yes. So government is deeply imperfect. But the challenge is that the mechanism of accountability that most people kind of use in order to as a critique of government itself ends up often underserving or malserving, if that's even a word, the citizenry. So in the case of Flint's again, a perfect example. The idea was that what they needed was another mechanism of accountability that better served the bottom line. So how'd that get translated into actual government? It was the way it was translated is that bottom line profit loss value end up being posited above every other value. And that brings us right back to that quote that we began the segment with. When Martin Luther King is speaking in 1967, he says, we've got to promote a new set of values in government so that those bottom line ideas aren't the ones that basically dictate how society is run.
We have to take another break here on Midday. I'm talking to Lester Spence, whose new book is Knocking the Hustle: Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. He's going to be with us for the rest of the hour. I hope you will join us, too. What do you think of this analysis? Do you agree the country should focus more on fixing the structures that keep black people from succeeding, or does that ignore personal responsibility? Give us a call, 410-662-8780. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be back in a bit. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm here in the studio with Lester Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins. He's the author of Knocking the Hustle: Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics, published last month by Punctum Books. Let me just go straight to Chris, who emailed us this thought. Quote, while by many standards the black community has suffered during the Obama presidency, my question for the guest is whether Obama's achievements will bolster the community over time. For instance, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, the CARD Act, the efforts of the Attorney General to prosecute against racial biases, all these won't have immediate effects but will build over the ensuing decades. Will Obama be better regarded once the full effects of his initiatives are felt?
That's a great, great question. And that's...
We have great listeners.
Yeah, dope. I think that what we're going to have once the years have passed is we're going to have a really, I think the line on Obama would be that he really missed a moment. So you take that moment when the bottom filed, when the housing bubble burst, and he could have, by a common, at the very least by rhetoric, posited a set of, expressed a set of support for a set of ideas that said we're going to save people who lost their homes or in the process of losing their homes first, before we deal with institutional investors, before we deal with corporations. We're first going to save them. And then through saving them, we're going to save everybody else. What that does, it establishes kind of another type set of principles and values and injects them into the discussion. And then when you do that, you then give people the ability to mobilize for more support for homeowners and then potentially politically organized for larger groups of larger populations. But when he instead takes a much more moderate approach, he then he takes an approach that ends up being far better than his Republican counterparts, but he ends up reducing the ability of people in the future to fight for a better society. So I think that
explain that. In what way has he reduced the ability to fight in the future?
Okay, so what he does what he wanted to do, right, when he ran for office, he was like, I'm going to use Ronald Reagan as my standard. And that sounded really, really weird for people on the left. Like, why Ronald Reagan? What Ronald Reagan did was single-handedly change how we thought of government. The reason we now tend to think that government actually hurts people is because Ronald Reagan, every chance he was talking about cutting taxes, saying that government was the problem. Now, the reality was that in policy, he couldn't do all of that. So we actually end up increasing taxes. But that rhetoric created a platform for people to build upon in the future. Whereas now, his party, you can't run on the idea of raising taxes and being a Republican. When I talk about how Obama reduced the capacity of people to organize and build, that's what I'm talking about. He could have rhetorically set up a framework whereby we're now naturally thinking that government is the solution to a wide range of structural problems. But we don't do that. And that's something that Obama can legitimately be blamed for, even given the fact that he had to work with one hand tied behind his back.
I'd like to play another clip from my interview with Tavis Smiley. It picks up in a different area some of what you're talking about. I asked him whether there's been any progress in criminal justice in Black America during the 10 years that his new book looks at. Tavis Smiley said that of any of the 10 covenants in the book, this one about criminal justice has seen perhaps the most progress. He began by citing some of the initiatives that former Attorney General Eric Holder had taken.
He addressed the issue of sentencing and made some changes there. You know, it used to be 10 years ago when this book came out initially, you had to get caught with 100 times more powder cocaine than crack cocaine to get the same sentence. That disparity used to be 100-1. It's gone down to 18-1 now in legislation, but it's still not the 1-1 that it ought to be. And so there have been some progress made on sentencing and on the things they're going to prosecute in this so-called war on drugs. And I would also add that of all the issues in the book, the Ten Covenants, this one presents, perhaps, Sheila, the most promise for bipartisan consensus. There are a number of Republicans now who are starting to understand and talking publicly, in fact, about the need to have some meaningful reform in our criminal justice system. What's funny about it is sometimes you do the right thing for the wrong reason, and sometimes we take different routes to get to the same place. I think the Democrats on this issue, certainly Cory Booker, are concerned about unequal justice in this country, and that's why they want to address these criminal justice reform issues. I get the sense that many of the Republicans, not all, but certainly many of them, are concerned more about fiduciary issues. They see the money that's being wasted They see that they see the money that's being spent on this mass incarceration nation that we become. So I think their motivations might be different, but at my age, frankly, I'll take it any way I can get it.
I wanted to bounce that off you, Lester Spence, because I was struck by that idea of doing the right thing for the wrong reasons, or for what Tavis Smiley would say would be the wrong reasons. And I kind of wanted to ask you the same thing, in that the hustle, working hard to get ahead for your family, for yourself. It seems to me that a lot of people do that not necessarily because it fits into some large schematic they see of their own lives, or even a larger schematic of American society, but it's like, I need to get to a better place right now. I need to do what I need to do, and I won't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. It will be good for my family if I make a little more money, or if, because I'm an ex-con and can't get a job, if I hustle on the side. It will be good, and I will do that. And are you perhaps setting up a perfect enemy of the good situation?
So first of all, it's important to note that folks aren't hustling to get ahead. Folks are hustling to maintain. Right.
Fair point.
Right. They're not hustling like, you know, to make enough money so they can buy a third car. They're hustling in order to keep up the payments on the car they have, in order to keep up their house note. Right. Now, and nobody can knock that. Right. So the Uber driver, you know, I really don't like Uber. Sometimes I'm quote unquote forced to use it. The Uber driver who has to make ends meet. Right. I'm not knocking the choice that individual makes. What I'm suggesting, though, is that what we've done is we naturalize the hustle. That is, we've made it such that that thing is the natural thing that people do.
It's the norm.
It's the norm. And if you don't act according to that norm, you're the one with the problem. And anything that happens to you is your fault. That's the thing I'm fighting against. And that's the thing that we see over and over again, not just in people's rhetoric, but again, in public policy, and that's something that we have to contest.
But what about the point I made heading into the last break? Some people would say it's you're putting too little stress on personal responsibility. You're saying fix the structures, fix the big problems. Nobody would say they shouldn't be fixed. But where does personal responsibility come into this analysis?
Well, I mean, you take a city like Baltimore, where our major employment sectors are like health services, education, and then I'm missing, there's one other sector that's really, really important. There are large swaths of Baltimore's population that simply can't, you know, ascend to those, or maybe individuals, right? So it's routine to hear about job fairs in which there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people who come, but there are only a few jobs to be had. So there's only given that structural deficit, I'm not sure that that the responsibility line, at least as far as individuals, works much. You know, I think that as far as the responsibility, we need to be suggesting that kind of institutional actors need to be more responsible.
Let me pull Mel into the conversation. Mel is calling us from Baltimore. Welcome to Midday, Mel.
Yes, I've been listening, and I respect the guy. You know, I hear everything he's saying, but I totally disagree. He's not talking about individual responsibility. He's totally and completely ignoring it. He's ignoring it. Look, and for your kids, want to go to college. All right, there was an African-American guy who worked hard. He built an app called Scully. Hundreds of millions of dollars are available. Hello?
Hello. Okay, let me ask Professor Spence to respond.
I went to the University of Michigan. 28 years ago to this day, students, me and a number of other and dozens of other black students actually forced the University of Michigan to take MLK Day off, to make it a national holiday on the campus. I attended Michigan. I was able to graduate with no debt, not because I was smart. I was super smart, but because we had massive grants available through the federal government. right? It was my responsibility to get in school, but it wasn't my responsibility to pay for it. Why would you put Hopkins now, Johns Hopkins now, their tuition is approximately $40,000 a year. So if a Baltimore kid could even get into Hopkins, right, from a high school that's not Poly, that's not Western, that's not City, right, they'd have to spend $160,000 just in tuition to actually go to get in and matriculate from Hopkins. Now, to be fair, Hopkins will cover a lot of that stuff, but there's going to be this huge chunk that the individual is responsible for that we weren't responsible for. I graduated from Michigan with no debt. Why should we put that responsibility now on a kid? You could take that same analysis and apply it to every single endeavor. What were they talking about? Poverty in Baltimore, whether we're talking about, you know, people trying to get jobs in Baltimore, people trying to buy houses, it's the same dynamic. So I really respect that the brother disagrees, and I take disagreement. But yeah, I'll make my argument, and I'll win every time.
Mel, we're almost out of time. Is there a 30-second response you can give, you want to give?
Yes, every effort, anything that's worth having has to be front-loaded with your efforts. And to not talk about that, to me, does a disservice to a lot of individuals. Whatever it is you want to do, you have to front load your efforts. And as I said before, millions of dollars are going untapped, and you download the app Scully, and it's millions of dollars available for scholarships.
Mel, I appreciate your calling.
Mel, it costs approximately $23 billion or be 23, it's probably not 23, 23 trillion, but it would cost $23 billion to educate every kid who wanted to go to a public college. So when you talk about millions of dollars, yeah, there's millions of dollars available, but we're talking about a college cost of $23 billion.
We are out of time. Mel, I appreciate your call. I appreciate the calls from everyone who called, and I especially appreciate being able to spend this time with Lester Spence, whose new book is Knocking the Hustle Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. There are so many issues in this book that we didn't get to, including the fact that it's published on Punctum Books and basically in 6 months is going to be
a free download.
Thanks to everybody for being part of Midday. And I would like to, if we have time, I'd like to hear a closing thought from Tavis Smiley on everything we've been talking about.
There's a distinct difference, Sheila, between optimism and hope. This book does not give us reason necessarily to be optimistic. And so while I might not be optimistic, I'm always hopeful. When hope got to black folk, it was stillborn. And yet in the great city of Baltimore, home of Billie Holiday and U.B. Blake and so many other great Americans, Cyrus Chestnut. In that great city, black people continue to keep hope alive. It's funny to me, interesting, that with all the hell that black folk have caught over the last 10 years, as detailed in this book, Sheila, black people in every poll, survey, and study continue to be the most hopeful about their future. I mean, you know black people in our faith tradition and the black prophetic tradition, you understand that. So we're still a hopeful people. And as long as there's breath in our bodies, we can do better. But we have to get serious about where we are, about what time it is, and what needs to be done. And I believe that if we do that and demand in this election cycle that they be held accountable to an agenda to make black America better, I believe we'll accomplish that. And when you make black America better, you make all of America better.
Again, I'm Sheila Cast. I want to thank our guest, Lester Spence. That was Tavis Smiley speaking to us. But Lester Spence has been with us this hour, professor at Johns Hopkins, author of Knocking the Hustle. Also want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today for Midday guests at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. You can learn more at thedizbaltimore.com. Thank you all for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.